Welcome to another fashioned episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jim. This week, our topic is Creator-Owned Heroes by Jimmy Palmiotti. And now, the cast begins.
Hey everybody, welcome to the 102nd episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name's Andy and I'm hanging out with David.
Hey.
And Jen.
Sup.
And this week we read Creator-Owned Heroes by Jimmy Palmiotti mostly and a bunch of other people. I want to give him most of the credit. I think it's his baby project. So this thing's really interesting because it's like, it's a full-page comic, but half of it is comic book and half of it's magazine, and the half that's comic is split up between two stories, American Muscle and Trigger Girl 6. And we'll talk about both of the comics, and we'll talk about the stuff in the interviews in the back as well. But I think I want to get out of the way first, like the whole format, the feel of it. What did you guys think? Did you like this kind of format?
Not so much, honestly, because mostly the comics half, because I felt like since I'm getting multiple stories at once, that I wouldn't be able to remember them month to month, which is kind of the reason I never read, Shonen Jump. And I always got, like, the collected things when I was reading manga back in the day. Because if you're only seeing these once a month and you get this tiny, tiny snippet, it's harder to remember it as a cohesive whole. On the other hand, the magazine part is super cool. It's kind of like those old, like, I don't know, super geeky magazines that they used to sell all the time in the 90s but have died out at this point.
Yeah, the now-deceased Wizard magazine.
Yeah.
What did you think, David? Did you like this?
Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it. It reminded me of, like, reading backups. You know how some comics have a backup story? You don't see it that much anymore. Justice League, the current Justice League in the New 52 started that, I think maybe month 7, where they have a Shazam backup.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, you read through the Justice League issue, and then there's, like, 4 or 5 pages of a Shazam story.
Huh.
And it's not, like, a quick little adventure. It's continuation, you know, it's a continuing story. So from that perspective, I didn't really have a problem with it. I can see where it could be forgettable, but I guess that's on the creator to make sure that it's an engaging story that you want to come back and read it and don't forget. Right.
Yeah. I don't know. It made me really nostalgic for, I don't know when they stopped doing it, but they used to have, like, letters to the creator sections in the back of comics. They used to have editor letters to the readers. They used to have, like, 2 or 3 pages of text in the back and interaction with the community of readers.
They still do that a little bit.
Some comics still have it.
I don't know. Maybe I just haven't read a new comic. Or maybe I've just stopped paying attention to it altogether. But I remember there used to be pages and pages of it, and I used to read those when I was a kid and really enjoy them.
Yeah, like, I know the current Fantastic Four does have it, where John Hickman responds to letters and stuff. And it's just like reading it in old comics, where it's full of wisecracks and stuff, you know?
The New 52 does it as well, and they have, like, a little section for letters, I think, and then a preview part, and then a little part interviewing creators where they're like, what was your favorite thing? And kind of, if you guys recall that big Starfire in a bikini scandal, that was actually featured in one of those little sections as the favorite page from the artist. I bet he was biting his tongue after.
Yeah, probably a little bit. So what like of the stuff in the back, did any of that, I mean, a lot of what we talk about is sort of what moments of the story you liked or what pages of art stuck out, and I think it's relevant and important to talk about with this kind of format of a comic book because it's unique. Did any of the sections in the back kind of stick out to you in your mind, or is there anything that you really wanted to talk about from the back of some of those?
Actually,
or is it all forgettable?
I enjoyed the cosplay section.
Just kidding. No, but that seriously, that was, I did like that when I came by.
I think
that,
it
I
is,
was like, that's pretty cool.
I agree that is a cool idea, because you never see the comic book, like, publishers and stuff, well, at least I've never experienced them talking about cosplay. I mean, they feature cosplay on their websites, and, you know, they talk about, oh, this person's got this cool costume and whatnot, but I feel like they don't acknowledge it too much, and so it was interesting to see.
Yeah, I really like that section, because the thing with that community is, as much as they dress up and they cosplay and they go to conventions, and there's this perception that so many people seem to have that all these people want to scream is, hey, come look at me, look at how cool I am, look at how awesome I am. And for a community with that perception, I think the actual, like, legitimate, you know, cosplay community almost goes out of its way to not over-publicize itself. You know, like, they have that perception because they go and they go in costume, but you don't see them talked about them. You don't see them coming out and saying, hey, look at me, look at this thing that I do, look at how cool it is. They might post how they made their costume. They might post a couple pictures from a photo shoot, but that's about it. It's not like they try to publicize themselves, really, or brand themselves too much.
And I think things like that, with cosplay in particular, it's still a very, it's a tight-knit community, right?
Yeah.
You can go to cosplay-specific websites where people talk about it and talk about it. But you don't, you know, you see, like you said, photo shoots on comic book websites. And
yeah.
And I feel like that's as close to mainstream as they ever get.
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of an underground culture, and it seems like it gets attention because, I mean, it's people going out in public in the craziest outfits you can imagine. But, you know, unless you're, I guess, prowling DeviantArt quite a bit or websites like that, you know, it's not something that most people are exposed to.
Yeah, and the majority of the press I think it gets is there will be one site talking about how, look at this costume is so source accurate, and look at how this person cosplaying this character is, like, perfect for the character, and you can tell that they know the character and love it. That's one, and then there's 50 that are hot cosplay chicks. And that's it.
Yeah.
You know, there's such a bad slant for the publicity for that community, and it feels like something like this is really good for that.
And I think even, like, there's got to be some portion of the community, maybe not cosplayers, but, like, booth babes that are dressed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, the ones that are paid to be there that don't even know who they're dressed up as.
I'm sure there are a good amount of cosplayers who end up coming across like that to people that aren't in the know.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to be comic book accurate. Like, for example, every Monday Comics Alliance has a best cosplay of the week article where they just put like 5, 6, 7, 8 cosplayers, and there's one of Emma Frost, okay? And there's some comments, and there are people saying, oh, you bitch couldn't jog in that costume or something to that effect. But if you look closely at it, she's actually, the person is, she's wearing like flesh-colored, like, I don't know, leotards instead of, so it's not like she's naked under this, you know,
yeah,
tiny bit of fabric. I mean, the people who are really into it, you know, they're not there to gain attention for anything other than the quality of their costume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of the costumes are not practical. So you can't really, when the character's design is hypersexualized, you can't really fault the cosplayer for being hypersexualized when they're the ones recreating that. Because, you know, if you're just trying to replicate a thing, what can you do?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So let's get back. It's not like we've never gone on tangents. But I think actually one of the sections that really stuck out for me was the little highlight that Phil Noto had in the back of the third issue.
Yeah.
Like talking about where his inspiration came from and a bunch of just his sketches. Because, I mean, we'll talk about his art and what he does with Trigger Girl later. But honestly, the only thing I've ever seen from Noto before was sketches and covers. I've never seen interior work. I've never heard him talk about his inspiration or anything. And so it was really cool to read that section from him. It was really interesting. And all the visuals were great. That picture that he has of on the first page was great. And then I think at the end of the Trigger Girl in issue 3, there's a really cool like preview for next month that looks awesome.
Yeah, it was, I think for me, the best way I could describe his art is it's very classy.
Yeah.
He just has this, like, really good modern 1960s, 70s mod vibe. And it's cool because it's something I'd want to see in a comic, and it's also something I'd want in my home and something I'd want to go and see in, like, an art exhibit.
Yeah.
And to kind of cover all three of those bases is really impressive.
Yeah. Was there a section that stuck out for you, Jen?
I really liked the author interviews, and I'm not just saying that because they interviewed Neil Gaiman first.
Not like you don't have any kind of attachment to him at all.
No, none whatsoever. Who is he? It was really topical, I guess, to interview creators in a comic/magazine about creator comics, because clearly it's not just for them to showcase their comics, it's to expose what it's like to work in this industry. I noticed, like, most of the interviews said, like, do you have any advice for people starting out? Which I appreciated that, among other things, Neil Gaiman said, you have to be good. Like, yeah, that's true. Yeah. And I just like this little look into people's creative lives, because you get the final product, but you so very rarely see the little things that go into it. Like, one of the guys was like, yeah, my studio's terribly messy, but I always wash my hands every time I'm inking. And it's just that sort of little thing you know about people really makes the comic more about the people who make it, which I think is really the driving purpose behind, you know, Palmiotti's whole publication here. So it fits so well.
Yeah, and I think it works because it's Palmiotti interviewing them, you know?
Yeah.
Because, like, that one that you brought up is a perfect example. I'm sure if somebody else had asked that question, like, what is your workspace like? The guy wouldn't have gone to that level of detail. But he knows that he's talking to somebody else who's in the business. And if he wants to tell something to Jimmy that's actually unique about his workspace, it won't be, oh, well, I use, you know, this kind of ink and this kind of paper or whatever. Like, that's not really going to be unique. Like, what are your actual little quirks and ticks that are make you truly unique? I mean, for somebody who's even in the industry, like, that's another level of uniqueness than he would have told to just a plain old interviewer or, like, a podcaster.
Yeah.
I think that's part of why it works. And it really came out with Mark Waid in an interview, too. Because they were, like, you could almost feel the comfortable back and forth between the two of them. Made it a lot more fun to read.
Yeah, it's definitely... Oh, no, my train of thought derailed, like, hardcore there. It's definitely a thing, you know?
Well, the other thing that we got to talk about is... Well, I don't know if I don't know how to bring this up in a good PC kind of way. Did you TLDR any of this? Did anybody? I will be the first to admit that I did.
Yeah, I did too. I kind of scanned them and was like, what seems interesting to me? And if it didn't, like, jump off the page, I didn't really spend a lot of time on it. Like, the Mark Waid interview was something I was like, oh, Mark Waid. And so I read that one, but...
Yeah.
A lot of the other ones I kind of just scanned. Even the Neil Gaiman one. Sorry, Jen.
That's okay. I skimmed Mark Waid.
Yeah. I think it got easier to dive right in as the issues progressed. I mean, the first issue, the back half, was super text-heavy and not especially visual. But by the third issue, even the articles were very visual. Like, there's the one page that has a giant thing of Queen Crab in the middle, which is awesome. And I was like... I don't know what this article is on first glance, but I want to read it because it's got this cool art in the middle of it.
Do we want to take some time out to talk about this one?
Sure. This guy, yeah. I don't know who this guy was. I don't know who he is. And yeah, some of the stuff was a little sketchy. Okay.
So I was admittedly drawn by Queen Crab too, because she is clearly Lobster Johnson's soulmate. I mean, I love this art. She's, like, crazy. She has the martini, and she, you know, she's clearly a very sexy crab lady. On the other hand, you know, I started reading this, and I got, you know, into it, and suddenly I hit this point where you're reading, and you say, okay, this guy, he's saying, you know, I like seeing these really strong women in comics. He starts out with that. And it's like, okay, let's see where you take this. And then he lists all the
stereotypes. That's my kind of thing, too.
Well, he lists all the tropes of the strong woman. You know, ordnance-wielding assassins, martially adept Asian cross-dressers, super spy femmes fatale, vengeance-seeking frontiers women, huge afroed black chicks armed with attitude and big-ass guns, leopard-skin-clad jungle girls, armored Amazons, etc., etc. Right? And so you're like, what's he going to overturn here? What's he going to comment on? You know, why list these? And then he's basically, to sum up his article, saying, well, strong women date back to all through human history, okay? And really, people shouldn't rag on creators because they all know that these women are unrealistic, and we can't fault them for the unrealistic portrayal, and both genders have fun with it, and when I was a kid, I saw strong women, and that got me into this, and, like, it eventually led into this rabbit hole of, and if we over-sexualize women, it leads to feminism. Now, okay, I'm being really unfair, because if you actually read it, it was only slightly less absurd. But
yeah, I mean, that's not too far off, though, because the second to last paragraph, he says something about, oh, you know, you go out and you see these stereotypical female characters that are in the movies, and they're supposed to be strong characters, but they're like bikini clad, you know, big breasted bombshells with giant guns. And it's so objective, you know, they're so objectified and all that kind of stuff. And then the next paragraph, he says, but really, you should be thankful for that because it made me a feminist. And like, did it really? Or do you just want to see more of that?
I mean, let's quote this dude. So when absorbing action confections with some badass bodacious babe at the center, just focus on it as what it's meant to be. Fun, pure and simple. Blah, blah, blah. Like, etc. No, because when you ignore social issues like that, when you ignore feminist issues in media, that's perpetuating them. And that's what he's actually saying, because he's like, you can't rag on creators. You can't ask for change. And, you know, that whole field is something that warrants a very good discussion, but it felt like this was a really shallow take on it.
Yeah.
Just, fuck you, dude.
I mean, at the very least, we can say that it is worth talking about, and the guy did bring it up, and I think that only adds value to the book.
Yeah, what I will say,
if we want to spin it nicely.
Okay, the thing that actually offended me about this was he basically said we shouldn't be upset about it. And he basically gave the, like, feminists have been getting their panties in a bunch about this for years. And it's like, I'm just like flipping off the monitor right now. Y'all can't see it, but it's happening. And, like, these things, you know I love Power Girl and her boob window. You know I love this illustration of Queen Crab right here. That's not the point. The point is how it's addressed. And sometimes it looks like this comic might be more, or, like, this magazine is more Jimmy Palmiotti features his friends, which is cool. I don't know Palmiotti's relationship to this dude, but I feel like it was not a good interview pick without having something on the opposite side to weigh it.
Well, yeah. This is, you know, it's some dude's editorial. Like, I'm not saying I agree with him necessarily, but, you know, it's his, we're supposed to read editorials and kind of not necessarily agree with them, but,
yeah.
You know, it is one dude's opinion, and, you know, opinions have value, I guess.
He's entitled to it. It's just...
Yes.
I just
rare that the an opinion that, gets me so angry.
Well, no, the thing that kind of bugs me about it is the way I'm reading it. We should take comics like Power Girl, and we should take comics like, I don't know, like the Aspen boobtastic kind of comics, like the Grimm fairy tales. And one has a little bit of feminist merit to it, and one is just pure cheesecake. And he's sort of saying, you should be equally thankful for both. Like, yes, they're both strong, sexualized female characters, but one has a lot more usefulness than the other. You know, and one legitimately could lead to a feminist person, you know, if they read it when they're young, and the other one will just lead to who the fuck knows what, because it's not really worth a whole lot.
I mean, and this honestly feels a little bit like lay off and stop talking about it, but part of what makes it so interesting, whether you appreciate portrayals of women like that or not, is that, you know, like, three people like us can get around a microphone and discuss this and say, what are the merits of Power Girl's boob window? Because, you know, there are. All right, Power Girl is a very cool character, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with sexualizing women. Just gonna say that, but it's how you do it, bro.
Yeah.
Well, it has to have some kind of value, right? Like,
yeah,
you don't want to do it. I mean, you wouldn't want to. The idea isn't to do it just to do it. I mean, that's the opposite of what feminists want, right?
Yeah, you can do it and have a purpose, and it's okay. So let's go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to, like, kind of clinch it and be like, either way, it's a topic that warrants discussion, so you can't shut that down.
Yeah. So, okay, let's... All right. That's, like, tangent number 3 or 4, and we're, like, 20 minutes in or so.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the actual stories in this. So let's start off with the first one of the first issue. Start off with American Muscle. Did you guys like this story so far, the first 3 issues worth?
It was okay. I'm saying that because I don't have a strong feeling about it either way. I didn't hate it, and I don't think it's bad, but it felt kind of... It feels familiar, and not in a necessarily a good way. You know what I mean? It's like, it feels like, maybe it's because we're like super saturated with zombie stuff lately.
But he says in the first one, they're not zombies. Apparently they're mutants, mutations.
Well,
I
sure,
remember there were mutants
sure,
somewhere
that's
in there.
Fine. But it feels zombie-like.
You're saying it might be kind of like the same way 28 Days Later is in the zombie movie? It's a rage virus movie?
No, that's not that egregious. And 28 Days Later is a good movie.
Yeah.
It is a good movie. This, I like the setting, okay? I do like the setting, but I don't know, it just feels the same.
Really? I don't know. That's, of everything in the story, that's what I dislike the most.
You don't like the setting?
I don't like the wasteland kind of thing. I love the muscle cars, I kind of like the characters, but I'm so tired of the desert wasteland area. And I don't think it's because I see it so much. I think it's because every single time I see it, it's always the longest, dullest walking from one side of the wasteland to the other part of any show I watch.
Wait a minute, Andy. Stop right. Let me stop you right there. Are you trying to tell me you don't like Mad Max?
Okay, I actually haven't seen Mad Max.
What?
I know. I need to get
you
to that.
You need to check with your local video rental agency.
Should I pick that up with Idiocracy?
Yes, you should.
Okay.
I can't believe you have not seen Mad Max. Now you're going to hate it. You're going to hate it now.
I'll reserve judgment. But for my two examples, I'll cite one that you know really well, David, which is One Piece, right? And there's Arabasta, where they're in like this desert wasteland, and it's the worst part. I've seen 400 episodes, and those are the worst.
Agreed. I agree with
they're
that.
The worst, because it's just, okay, now where are we going to go? I don't know. Let's just drive through the desert for another fucking 4 episodes. And the same thing kind of happens in one that you know, Jen, which would be Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Yep.
When they're in the desert, it's the fucking worst.
Well, I've seen Airbender also.
I know, but she hasn't seen One Piece, so I figured I'd divvy it up like this.
I do want to take a moment here, though, and point out the desert art in this comic. If you actually look, it's really beautifully rendered by Kevin Mellon.
Yeah.
Like, it's not actually that boring. The line work is interesting, and it adds action to each panel. And he does this really cool, like, watercolor splatter for the sky that I love. So...
It's not that the art's bad. I like the art, and I think if you're going to have a comic with a wasteland, this is a well-drawn wasteland. I just have some weird predisposition to hate the idea of a wasteland.
Because for me, like, the art kind of makes the setting, and if the art's boring, I don't care. But, like, normally, I'm kind of like, wasteland varies. But this seems engaging because it's actually... barren yet alive, it feels to me, so I feel like something interesting can happen.
Okay. I mean, and to be fair, I really loved the two-page splash where you had the Hollywood sign and all of L.A. sunk underwater.
Yeah, that was a cool shot.
That was awesome.
Maybe I like this more than I initially thought.
Now that I'm ragging on it, you're going to rally for its defenses?
Well, see, like, here's there is something I wanted more of from this comic, especially because it's called American Muscle. I wanted more about the cars, and it seems like the cars were just... They could have been anything. It could have been a horse. It could have been a helicopter.
Hey, look, here's a Valiant, and here's a Mustang, and here's another generic muscle car.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, they could have been Toyota Camrys. Because I felt like, man, they're going to call this comic American Muscle, and it didn't feature the cars that much. The cars, I feel like, need to be characters if they're going to get away with calling it American Muscle. And maybe I need to just read more than the first three issues, but at this point, I'm a little bit sad.
Yeah, maybe we'll get there. I don't know.
Because don't you feel like this isn't just a wasteland story. This is a travel. This is like it's a travel journey, right?
Yeah.
Travel journey. So like have you guys seen Zombieland?
Yes.
I feel like the cars that Woody Harrelson's character drives are characters, cuz first he has the Escalade with the snowplow on the front.
Yeah.
And then later they have the yellow Hummer, and he puts like the numbers on the side. It's like they become characters in the movie too, and a comic named American Muscle should have American Muscle more prominently featured.
Yeah, or at the very least, Woody Harrelson's cars are an extension of his character. Like, you look at him and you look at that car and you don't have any question that they belong together. Right?
Yeah.
And maybe it's harder to do with a thing like American Muscle, because muscle car is muscle car for most people, and the nuances between the two. I mean, the character of a Valiant versus the character of an old school, like, I don't know, Dodge Dart. you know, for the average reader, they probably wouldn't be able to ferret out the difference.
Right, but you can say, like, I think most people could say that's a muscle car, right?
Yeah.
Like, they have similar lines, no matter what they are. I'm sure some people will probably get some angry emails, maybe. But they have an attitude about them. And so you can look at this and you can say, yes, those are definitely muscle cars.
Yeah.
But they like I said, I feel like they could have been anything.
I'm going
to... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Jen.
I was just... I'm going to admit, until I actually got to the end of the first magazine issue and read the thing by Steve Niles where he was talking about cars, I didn't even realize the car connection between the title and muscle cars. So
you just thought it was about buff people?
Yeah, I mean, it sounded like generic tough guy squad thing, and I was like, okay, and just like turn the page. So I like, yeah, the connection there wasn't so hot.
See, and I think maybe if they had made the connection more prominent, you would have realized.
Yeah, I might have.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe,
it doesn't matter what kind of muscle cars they are.
Yeah, and I mean, like you said, maybe that's something that will be ferreted out later. But I think getting down to it, Wasteland stuff aside, I actually did like these stories. But I think what made me more reserved when I read them, what made me less excited about jumping in and engaging myself with these characters in this story, is that it felt so short. It felt like this was supposed to be a big story. Right? But where this creative team normally would get, you know, 18 pages worth of comic to draw and write, they're getting like 9. And it feels more like they have an idea for a novel and we're getting it a chapter at a time instead of like a chunk at a time or like a half a chapter. It feels like I'm not getting enough to keep me engaged to the point where I want to like buy into the story.
I think that is a problem with the way media is delivered nowadays. Because if you think back, this is the way a lot of things were delivered. I mean, there were science fiction magazines and that was how people got their sci-fi stories. There's lots of like Philip K. Dick novels and things that were originally were serialized in magazines. And so if you were a sci-fi fan, you would just have to wait a month to figure out what happened next. And nowadays, everything's like fast. You know, you can get your tablet and you can get that novel put on there right away, and you can ride the bus and read and do all that stuff all at the same time. You can just plow through things at your own pace. But when media was doled out in small portions, I think it maybe added to the suspense. But nowadays we're like, where you can get the trade paperback of, or the omnibus, where you can get 100 issues of Superman yep. and go through it at your own pace. You don't have to wait anymore. So when you are forced to wait, it feels a little bit different. And even TV is the same way nowadays, right? There's a lot of TV shows I wait until they're on Netflix to watch.
So that you can get them and digest them a season at a time?
Yeah, or how at whatever pace I want. I don't have to wait a week to see what's going to happen to Doctor Who or whoever, you know?
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. Because I'm trying to think about why that reasoning works so well, and I'm thinking about American Muscle, but then I also think about Trigger Girl 6, and it doesn't seem to have this problem in my mind. Like, I've bought into Trigger Girl 6, and I want to know what happens to her, and I want to know what the hell is going on. And I've bought into that, and it has just as many pages as American Muscle. But for some reason, I'm not as into American Muscle. I think, I don't know, maybe because with Trigger Girl 6, the whole premise is there in the first issue. And with American Muscle, there's this bigger world that they're traveling around in. It feels like this story is so much bigger than what I've seen, but my vision for it's limited. I don't know, but you're right, though. I mean, part of it is, why don't I just wait and see what another walled city looks like? Why am I not patient enough for that?
And I think American Muscle does a good job of being compact. Like, all three issues end at logical points. Like,
yeah,
first issue ends when they get to their destination and it turns out to be a disappointment. The next issue, they wake up and one of the characters is gone. And then the third issue, they rescue that guy and now they're on the run. And,
yeah,
you know, the delivery is good, but maybe because you don't like it as much as you like Trigger Girl 6, you're less patient.
Yeah, I don't know. Because you're right. Every issue has a good amount of action. I mean, the first one just, bam, hits you with it right in the face, first page. They're, like, heading toward a cliff.
You know, I think part of it is American Muscle really feels like a continuous story told in a serial fashion, and they're kind of like just picking up. Trigger Girl 6, I'm going through each little issue, and they're more like these, they're almost standalone vignettes that work together. Because you take that first issue, you could have ended it right there after she attacked the jet, and yeah, you'd have questions, but at the same time, it's not like American Muscle where you're like, well, what is the city, you know, what does it look like, where are they going, where are they coming from? Trigger Girl 6 is more cloaked in mystery, and I think you mentioned this, Andy, like, in the notes, it starts at 6, and I'll let you talk about that, too.
Oh, but, yeah.
We start in the middle, and we're just given this little, almost a portrait of what happens here. And I think that makes it feel like you can separate out these little instances and not have it be really confusing or make it feel like you're being led along.
Yeah, I think I should probably just say what I wrote in the notes. Now I get back. Yeah, that might actually be it, is that, like, you know, they tell you, like, the good story thing to do. If you're a good writer, you believe in the power and ability of your reader, and you put your reader in the middle of the story and let them catch up. And that way you're right in the middle of things, you're right in the middle of action, and then when they catch up, they'll be invested in the story the same way the characters are. That's the idea, right? And for American Muscle, they're doing that. They put you in the middle of the story. These guys, they're not showing you getting them sick of the walled city. They're not showing you them leaving. They're not showing you how they got together. They're just saying they fucking got in cars, they fucking left, and here they are, and you catch the fuck up. But they're doing the same thing for Trigger Girl 6. It's the sixth one. But we aren't really at the beginning. I mean, we get all these questions that the president has, right? Like, why are they trying to kill me? Why are they this? Why are they that? And all those sort of things. But we're also, while we're in the middle and we're catching up with everybody else, we're also starting from the same point that Trigger Girl 6 is. I mean, it's the middle of the story, but it's the beginning of the sixth iteration. That's what I had in the notes. Sounds smart when I say it. I feel all, ooh, like I did something right.
You look super smart. Good job. That was not as meant to be as patronizing as it sounded.
That's okay. I invited that.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it, though. And if you look at the writing, too, like, telling time in comics through writing is so difficult because you have to trust your artist to nail it, too. But here, Palmiotti kind of, he puts us in a little time bubble where we get all the relevant facts. I think in every issue where it's been relevant, the president's like, why you look like my mom? And in every issue, they have some random person being like, it's a Drigger girl, run away. And that feels like all you need to know.
Yeah.
Like, the dialogue here, too, is so sparse, it almost feels like the art can just tell you the story, and that's all you need. Whereas you have to build a cohesive narrative in your mind when you're reading American Muscle.
Yeah, and I think, I'm hesitant to say this because I don't like to judge the ability of a writer based off of a direct comparison or anything, but I feel like American Muscle is a bigger, better story idea than Trigger Girl. But Trigger Girl is a story that's executed by a more skilled or at least more refined writer, if that makes any kind of sense. Like, American Muscle seems like it's got this awesome, huge world with this long history, and this guy has a future plan up for where these characters are going to go, or at least has built a world where he could send them anywhere and the story will write itself. Like, so much creative power has been done. But with Trigger Girl, it feels like so much of the great work is happening within the issue that you're reading. Right? Like you said, the smart little lines just dropping this here, that there. The little hints that just is all you need. Like, it's much tighter, more efficient writing. But maybe a smaller world or maybe a smaller story. I don't know. Maybe it's just tighter scope.
Do you guys feel, actually, I just realized this. For a minute, I was like, I feel like I've read Trigger Girl 6, and I think it's because when we read Greg Rucka's Black Widow, I feel like this is that, but better done. The secret lady spy who doesn't know, like, her own identity and needs to figure it out and wants answers.
Well, I think this is that story without the weird face-off stuff.
Yeah. But that was, like, the bad part.
Yes. So, okay, we've been dancing around it. Do we want to talk about Trigger Girl 6 and that story? Like, we've been making the comparisons and talking about it, but we haven't actually talked about it.
Let's do it.
Did you guys like this story?
Yeah.
The Trigger Girl stuff? It seems like we like this one a lot.
Yeah.
So, I'm gonna go ahead and I'll start off this conversation. I'm going to let you bounce it to you guys, but I'm going to do it. I've never seen any interior work from Phil Noda before. I've only ever seen sketches. Like, I follow him on Tumblr and stuff, and his sketches are awesome. And I've seen his covers. He did a set of amazing covers for Birds of Prey that were just awesome. But I've never seen interior work. And I want to say, from that perspective alone, this comic's super interesting. To see how a guy that I know does this work, see how he handles interior work. And, like, how he lays out panels and how he lays out pages and how he handles that.
Yeah, he's very minimalist, and it's amazing, like, these pages are so white and so blocky, and yet there's so much weight to them. Like, do you feel that too, or am I just crazy?
No, I think you're right. I think, like, the first page of American Muscle pulls you in with, like, action, and it has all this action on the page, and then the text boxes are like, there's this fucking wasteland, we're outside the walls, we're not safe, and action. It's like, booyah, all the way. And it's like, it wants to pull you in with this balls-to-the-wall mentality. And then Trigger Girl starts out the exact opposite. It's like, here's this person chilling in a bath.
Well,
it's not exactly that.
I think what Trigger Girl gets you with is, I think there's obviously there's a sexy lady, right? But there's mystery. Because it's like, okay, here's this person, they're waking up, they say, don't say anything to her, don't talk to her, right? That's what the little narration will say. And then all of a sudden, she gets dressed, door opens, and she's in a room full of guns.
Yeah.
Now you know shit's about to go down. But you don't know what, because it's all mysterious and stuff. I don't think you realize, even at that point, that she's a spy or anything. So, I think they use different hooks to get you.
Yeah, and I think this uses a lot of really good art. Like, I'm just looking at the pages, and they are pretty.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I feel so tempted when looking at his pages for this to use words that I try to reserve, like when I'm trying to sound really smart at the Modern Art Museum. But no, like, there's a certain, like I said already, weight, but there's also like a quietude to his work, if that makes any sense, because it's so minimalist, but very, it's almost like a lot of comics. Oh, here it is. Comics are so in your face. You know, you're like, here's Power Girl's titties, and here's Wonder Woman kicking someone's ass, and here is Superman punching someone really hard, and you see that. And this reserves action. Even the explosions are so toned down and so quiet in this comic. They're just part of the background. They're there. And this focus just zooms in on Trigger Girl 6. And we're meant to really think, like, wow, this character has so much, I guess, like, a dignity about her. Because it's not about the flash and the flare and the cheesecake. It's about how she's this, like, really, she has, like, strength in her quiet, kind of.
I'm sorry, I'm just laughing, because right when you were saying about how she has this quiet dignity after the explosion parts, and all I was thinking, yeah, the explosion's happening behind her, and she's not even smiling, she doesn't even look, and I'm like, that's right. Cool characters don't look at the explosion.
Never look back, yeah.
Of course she's awesome. Cool guys never look back.
But that's the thing. Like, that's usually reserved for cool guys, and they got their sunglasses right. It's not something usually given to female comics characters. And, like, she's masculine. She's very feminine and masculine. She's pretty, she's sexy, and she's strong. And she's very, I love her. And I love her, I think, mostly because of the art.
So do you guys remember the TV show Aeon Flux? I think it was more than just a TV show. But
yeah. Well, I saw the movie.
Yeah.
Well, there was, MTV used to have this show, like, in the early 90s called Oddities, and it was a bunch of animated shorts, and they had an animated short series for Aeon Flux.
Okay.
And so this kind of reminded me of that from, I mean, obviously they're both, like, lady super spies, but the setting felt very similar. Like, everything's kind of soft, but sterile at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, we get a lot of flat surfaces, and it's, like, clean concrete. Even the place where, in issue 3, where she meets the people living on the street, like, even their, like, little hobo town seems pretty clean and sterile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of, like you said, adds to the quiet of the setting and of the art. There's even the setting, the places where there's a lot going on, like there's a lot of people standing around these burning trash cans, right? They're not that busy, you know, and so it feels very.
Yeah, and no, you're right. And there's a scene where it could be really busy, where she's fighting them. There's so much opportunity for a big, like, 8-on-1 fight to get really busy really fast. And I think Filinotto does a good job of splitting it up the panels and being like, here's this punch to this guy, this one to this guy, and this guy to this guy, so that it lets you, it's great use of gutters. It lets you fill in the gap of her movements, showing you took out 8 guys methodically, right? And it makes what could have been a really messy scene really, really clean.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, kind of what this reminded me of was Tron, and that's not just because I love Tron, and I always think of Tron. It's, I don't know, like the first scene where she's like, you know, gets out of the bath and gets dressed and straps on some guns just reminds me of the armory scene in Tron Legacy where, like, they cut off his clothes, they put on his armor, they give him a weapon and say, get the fuck out there. I mean, it's not exactly parallel, but I think the cleanliness of the style kind of makes that parallel. Like, Tron has a really, really clean aesthetic with strong lines, and this comic has a really, really clean aesthetic with strong lines. It's very, very different style in the end, but I think that might be why it feels, and from what I've seen of Aeon Flux, it's not dissimilar from that either. It's very clean.
Yeah. It's like almost sterile. I think you can go beyond clean and say sterile.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even the dirty parts look sterile.
Yeah.
Relatively yeah. speaking.
I mean, these are like the cleanest hobos you'll ever see. Ever.
Well, I mean, think about where, because she's essentially in an alley, right? Now think of another comic where there's lots of alleys, like Batman.
Yeah.
And alleys don't look like this in Gotham City.
Oh, no.
Fuck no. There's banana peels and shit everywhere.
Yeah. Surprised Batman never slips on one.
Hell for Mario Kart players. Yeah, and but we've gushed about the art long enough. I think I like, with the story stuff, I think there's a lot of little hints that we're not in today's world. We're in a sort of dystopian near future. I don't know how true that's going to end up playing, but like outside of what's going on with Trigger Girl, it's hard to get a feel for this world. Right?
Yeah, I agree with you. It seems like technology is just a little bit beyond us. I mean, she's being tracked by like a drone in issue 3.
Yeah.
And they have tracking mist, right?
Yeah, and the hobos say something about everybody's poor nowadays or everybody hates the president. And I don't know, there's something in the dialogue that makes me think it's more than just like, oh man, that Obamacare is turning us into communists. You know, it's like more than just that level of complaining. It's like legitimately the world's kind of fucked a little bit.
Yeah,
Something is just off a little bit more than it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the sterility of it adds to that, right? Because in every big old dystopia we've seen, like, it's too perfect, right? And it's creepy nice. And that's what this is. You see rats, but also, like, no trash.
Yeah.
In Gotham, or like, I always think of the stupid back alleys in Spawn when I think of alleys in comics, right? And
Spawn.
In Spawn, it's like it's filthy nasty and there's rats and animals and stuff, but you don't get that here. So it almost feels like there's stuff being swept under the rug. And what is it? Hmm. Matt, okay.
I got a
big question.
Okay.
That last page in that third issue where the person's saying, "Welcome home, daughter." Do you think that's like the projection there? Do you think that's the president's mom?
The dead mother?
Or like, do you think she's alive?
I don't
know.
It's
the president's grandma. I don't know.
That could be. Maybe it's the president's grandmother and the president actually killed the mother. And so that's the motive for sending these Trigger Girls after him. Because her son-in-law killed her daughter. Her daughter.
I gotta say, with that green light, she kind of looks like a guardian of the universe.
Well, didn't he say, like, why does this assassin look like my mother when she was 20?
Yeah.
So maybe he thinks she's dead and it's like she's aged now because she can't be 20 anymore. He's middle-aged.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to judge.
That's a little impossible.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I mean, if that's the case, why is his mom trying to kill him? So
I don't know, but I want to keep reading this. I want to keep reading it so bad. So, okay, do we want to get into the whole, do we want to do the conversation about creator-owned stuff? We kind of got into it with the horrible Spawn episode, but I really do think it's cool that a lot of these higher tier creators like Jimmy Palmiotti are going out there trying to do stuff independently so that they can have this space to do the things they want to do and tell the stories they want to tell. And that if it's successful, they can give that space to other artists too. So these other artists can do the things that they want to do.
I have some thoughts on that. And they feel a little biased and maybe a little mean. What I like about this is that we get to see established creators doing what they want to do. I think part of Todd McFarlane's downfall was that he wasn't terribly experienced in the industry. And I mean, the industry kept like kicking him back and saying, we don't want this, we don't want this. And, you know, like, he probably had stuff to work on, and it wasn't from... My guess is that it wasn't because they thought Spawn wouldn't fit into their whole big idea. It's that they were like, no, you need to go back and, you know, kind of go through the same process a lot of other people have. I don't know, honestly. I can't say, but it feels like that. And here, what's so nice is we're seeing established people, and these people we think of, like, as the greats in comic, like Connor and Palmiotti doing these things, Justin Gray, like, we get to see them and say, okay, so these guys, I've seen them write this, 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 and this, but what do they come up with creatively when given completely free rein? And that's what's really neat about it.
Yeah, I don't know. I just also think there's... One of the interviews, I hate to do it, but I don't remember who, but one of the interviews somewhere in here said something about how it seems like so many creators, what they want to do is they want to be part of the big two. They want to be DC or Marvel. And barring that, it's easy to make a comic, but it's hard to get visibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I feel like, yeah, you could do a Kickstarter, but if you're not part of the big two ever, it's hard to get your Kickstarter noticed because nobody knows you. And so then you have to show a lot more of it, and you have to have a lot more done, and by then you're done with it. And what are you kickstarting? It's a weird catch-22 in this industry. If you're not part of the big two, it's a weird catch-22. And I feel like what I would love to see from a magazine format like this is, like, get the established creators to do the two ongoing bigger stories like this, and then maybe cut out the editorial and put in, like, a three-page short story version of a comic book, or maybe it'd be flash fiction if it's only two or three pages of comic book, and give some young creator who seems to be really good, give them two or three pages and say, make a complete story in two or three pages, and at least you'll be in print in a magazine that gets decent, you know, decent distribution, that has these other names, Phil Noto, Jimmy Palmiotti, you know, Mark Waid on the cover, or Neil Gaiman, like, it has these other names attached to this comic, like, you know, it's not a piece of junk that just some random person decided to make. I feel like I would love to see that in this. Or,
you know, they could even team up a newcomer with an established person, and so they could get some mentorship. And, you know, they could learn the ropes while contributing to the comic community, right?
Yeah. Because, I mean, you know everybody in this... Everybody who's contributed to this book goes to how many conventions a year? I don't even want to count the total number of conventions that all these people have been to. Right, but they have to have seen great artists in artist alleys. They have to have seen great artists walking around that just are dying for a chance to get noticed. And maybe they're too focused and they only want to do Batman, or they only want to write, you know, fucking Namor or some shit. You know, but, like, maybe that's their life's ambition and that's all they want to do. But, like, I don't know. Some of them, maybe I want to see. I don't know.
Sorry. The idea of drawing Namor as someone's life's ambition is just too funny for me.
Maybe they're really good at drawing green Speedos.
But, you know, like, maybe it comes from me going through these artist alleys and seeing great art on these tables and me wanting to buy a sketch. But then I know, two tables over, there's this guy who wrote this thing 6 years ago, or who drew this thing 6 years ago that I really, really loved. And I got the sketch, and I can only buy one sketch. And if the art quality is about the same, I'd rather get it from the name that I know, because then be like, yeah, this is by that guy who did that cool thing 6 years ago. It gives me that little bit more. But I want to see what the other guy can do, you know, more than just me giving him $20 for another sketch of Booster Gold or something.
That's true, but on the other hand, I mean, digital publishing is very democratic. I mean, how much does it cost us to host the website, like, just our domain name a year? It's like $10, right?
Well, the domain and the hosting, it's like $150 a year.
Oh, really? Holy shit. I remember we were, like, shopping for a domain and it was like $11 or something.
The domains are very cheap. It's hosting and reliable serving that gets more expensive.
Okay, well, apparently I need to know more about the back end of our production here. So, I mean, still, even if you are a person who is mostly employed paying your bills, you could just take some of your, like, expendable cash if you have any. And if you have a passion for this, you could set that up. And you don't, honestly, you don't even necessarily need to pay that amount for the hosting if you want to put it up on Tumblr or something. It can be free. And when people see things online, if they really like it, they spread it. They talk about it. And I know that's such a hard way to go, and it's much harder than getting picked up by DC and getting your name on a book, right? On the other hand, like, it really is everybody who has the skill to do this. If they have the motivation, they have a chance. So, yeah. I mean, I'm totally not against, like, this magazine picking up some, like, people we've never heard of, because that'd be cool. But it's kind of an optimistic publishing world right now. I'll put it that way, if you're the digital.
Yeah. There's already been, in interviews in the back of these three issues, there's been people talking about the state of the industry and how it is hard to break in and how it is hard to maintain an independent comic because it's increasingly a market that's about niche characters, right? Like, people go in, they don't care who's writing or drawing, but they want to buy Batman. Right, like, they don't care. They just want to buy Batman. It doesn't matter how bad it is. It doesn't matter how good it is. So many people go in because that's the character, and they buy the things with Batman in it and fuck all everything else. And I think it's increasingly that way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's probably harder when you're not an adult, because I remember being a kid and being dirt poor with my allowance, right?
Yeah.
And you go into the shop, and you're like, well, I can buy this cool-looking indie comic, and it's like exactly what you said. You go to Comic-Con, you can get the sketch, or you can get the sketch by the guy you know. They're kind of equally good. You go with what you know.
Yeah.
So, it was tough.
Yeah, and I think it makes it difficult. It makes it so difficult to make an original character. You know? Which is why I admire this project and why I wanted to do it. It's like, you know, I just imagine these creators going, I want to do something original. I don't want to do another fucking Kickstarter. I want to do an ongoing comic, and I want to do something original, and I want to do it in a format that lets me do another original thing later when I get bored of this original thing. You know? And it's like, I would love it so much if this picked up and was ongoing for a long time.
Yeah. This is something that I would happily pay money for on a monthly basis. And, oh man, you know how, okay, I guess it's kind of a dying breed, but you can get magazines shipped to your mailbox once a month? Like, they should do that with this, because honestly, I am so lazy. I'm not going to make it to the comic store monthly, and if it's not a trade I'm picking up, or things that I'm, you know, collecting voraciously, yeah, I won't forget to pick it up. But if they did, like, a subscription service where, because I like paper copies of things, if they mailed this to me, I'd be so thrilled. They got to do that.
I know Marvel still mails directly. I don't think DC does anymore, and I don't know about Image, because this is an Image comic. I don't know, but I know Marvel still does do that. You can go to Marvel.com, and you can say, I want to subscribe to these four comics. You pay for the subscription, I think, for the year, and you get the year of that comic. Just like you would, like, a magazine for Popular Mechanics or something.
That's cool.
And yeah, it'd be great if Image did that with this.
If Jimmy Palmiotti listens to this, which would be amazing, and if you're listening...
Dude.
Thank you, but...
you say it's amazing? Have either one of you guys checked out our Twitter feed recently?
Yeah, it's, like, mind-blowing.
I was so stoked. I got on the Twitter feed, and it said Jimmy Palmiotti is now following you, and I almost shat myself.
Oh my god, that's a new
development. How fucking sick is that?
Well, that's awesome.
Well, now you have to tweet this to him, Andy.
Dude, I think it's so funny that we have had more feedback from industry people than we had fans.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
It's weird. It's so weird, but I love it. I would rather have five industry people than 50 fans.
But see, we're having the same problem that people that are trying to break into the comic industry have, right? It's hard to get your name out there.
Oh, snap. That was a good segue back on track. And I just pointed it out exactly like you're not supposed to do. But yeah, you're right.
We should...
We know what you feel like, struggling artists.
We should kickstart this to get it mailed to me. That's what we should do.
No, but you're right. I mean, I'm sure... I think that's a great parallel, David, because we do this primarily because it's fun and we enjoy it. But at the same time, if in like another 6 months we look at our listenership and say, no, seriously, there's only 5 people listening and it's cool that it's Gail Simone and Jimmy Palmiotti and like these other like 3 people and then like, you know, my fiance, your wife, and like your cousin.
Yeah.
You know, like if it's those 5 people, that's great. But, like, seriously, it's a lot of time and money. You know, like, as a creator, you got to sit and think, it's great that these people are enjoying it, but is that enough to keep me motivated? Is that enough to justify the time and effort and cost of doing it, no matter how much you love doing it?
That's so sad to think about.
I know, right? It's so sad. But you know there are so many artists out there and so many comic book creators out there who are just like that. Like, they're writing this comic anyway, but at a certain point... Fuck, if nobody's reading it.
Yeah, on the other hand, I think that's why people succeed. Like, okay, Neil Gaiman, for instance, said you have to be really good. But if you've read other interviews with him, he's been rejected a whole bunch of times, especially when he was starting out. I mean, people do these things because they love them. And when people know they need to write or draw, like, that's part of their life and they're going to do it one way or the other. So, you know, I guess might as well do what you love and try to pitch it and hope it gets bought.
Yeah. All right. Well, do we have anything more to say or should we rate this?
Let's rate this.
All right, Jen, you go first since you said that.
Since I have enthusiasm?
Yes.
So now you're roped in.
No. I'm going to give this I'm going to give this a 4. I found the comics intriguing. I guess I've been kind of on a... I've had a hankering for end-of-the-world apocalypse. And I think American Muscle, even though I didn't quite get the car connection at first, did fulfill that. I looked at that and I was like, hey, they're not trying to replicate Walking Dead. I'm going to keep reading this. And it wasn't just... like it felt original and it also felt very classic. There's some really good old classic sci-fi... that's kind of people trekking through America trying to find out what's out there after apocalypses things. And, you know, Trigger Girl 6 was so cool. I love the art. I'm actually going to go online after this and see if maybe I can get some prints to hang on my wall or, you know, just some art for my home because I like it so much. And... the magazine part is really unique. I love it. I don't necessarily agree with all the articles, as we have and, you know, like, yeah, I feel a little bit too mean, I think, saying it, but, ooh, it made me angry. But I guess that's good, because it got a discussion going, and that's kind of the point of things, too.
Yeah.
So, I like the idea that they're doing creator-owned comics, and they're not just saying, like, here's some comics, they're also saying, here are some creators. And I think that really... it gives it something new and something exciting, because we've seen all the silly little interviews with random artists where the interviewer's like, so, what do you think of when you draw Batman? Or, like, you know... how does someone get to work for DC? And Palmiotti asked pretty good questions here. And as you said earlier, it's nice to see creators talking with each other because I think there's a different level of openness about it. So it's unique, and I'm actually probably going to keep breaking into your comiXology that you so kindly share with us to read this every month that it comes out because, I mean... ooh, there's the other thing about this. It's short and sweet. Reading 3 of these took me less than an hour. And that was a nice little, like, comics fix. So yeah, a 4.
Okay. David, do you want to go or should I?
I'll go.
Okay, make it happen.
I'm going to give this a 4 as well. I think this was... I love the whole idea behind this series, I guess. I guess it's... is it a magazine? We'll call it a magazine. Yeah, I think I just love it. It's something different. It's cool to see what people, what these people who, you know, they're artists who often, you know, take direction from an editor. So maybe they're limited in their creativity to a certain degree. We get to see people's distinct styles in normal comics from the big two. But when they're published in a format like this, it's really cool because you get to see what, you really get to see these people's creativity shine. And so from that perspective, I think it's great. And like Jen said, it's cool to that these people get a voice outside of telling a story. Because, you know, like you said earlier, Andy, it's people often buy comics for the characters. And I'm like that to a degree, certainly. There's certain comic book characters or teams that I will probably always get. But at the same time, there are writing or creative teams that I also am drawn to, and I will pick up their comic, even if it's not something I usually do.
Yeah.
But this is, I think this is a great, it's another way to enjoy the art form that is comics. And it feels less like normal entertainment media. Even though it is, we get to see some really cool stuff. So I definitely am going to continue taking a look at this series. So 4.
All right. Let's make it 4s all around. Yeah, everything you guys just said. No, but seriously, I really like the format, and I think just reading from issue 1 to issue 3, you can get how it's getting better. The second half, I mean, there's the comics half, and then there's the word half. And from issue 1 to 3, they've played around with the order a little bit and everything. But I like that as it's going along, it's finding its footing, whereas by issue 3, there's the comics half and there's the words half. But even the words half gives you something really visual and interesting to look at. Like, there's that article we talked about for so long, the editorial, but there's a cool Queen Crab picture on there. The Phil Noto stuff, oh my god, I love that art that he has with his little article. It's just, it's amazing. And I like the idea of there being something on the shelf that's just like, okay, I said, Phil Noto, here's 3 pages. Make some shit that fills 3 pages. Draw whatever the fuck you want. You want to draw this? Draw this. You want to draw that? Draw that. You have 3 pages. Just draw something. I don't care what, and I'll put it in. That's awesome. Because then not only do we get to see Phil Noto's awesome art, but we get to see a little bit of his personality through that art. And then we get a little bit of him talking about why that art is part of his personality and where the inspiration for this art came from and how he got to this style. Like, I don't know what it is about that little bit with Phil Noto, but that's like, I loved that bit, and I want so much more of that. And I mean, there's good interviews in there too. Like, in issue 1, the one with Neil Gaiman was great, and in issue 3, the one with Mark Waid was great. And the interviews and a lot of but you know, a lot of the sections were almost talking about themselves. I think Justin Gray has sections like that, where he's just like, I don't know, this is what the fuck I can write on the page. Like, even those are kind of interesting to read. I like this format, and I hope it continues, and I want other people to buy it and read it, because I think it's great. And I think the more popular they get, the more feedback they get, the more it's going to go in the direction that we're all hoping it's going to go, where you get creators just getting to create, and you get to see their personality and something they really, really love on the page, which I think always translates into a better story. So yeah, 4. That's my rambling answer. So, next week, we're going to continue our host choice, as if every series isn't a host choice series.
I think I pointed that out to you. Yeah,
you're like, isn't every series just one that we picked because we said, fuck it, we want to pick it? So yeah, next week, we'll read Jen's choice, which is Runaways. We're going to do Volume 1 by Brian K. Vaughan. That's issues 1 to 6 from 2003. And I think it's a Marvel comic, but it's under the Tsunami imprint.
Yeah, it was published in little manga-sized books instead of the normal comic format.
Yeah. So look for the slightly smaller comic book. Is it red left to right still? Because it's a Western... It's still just a normal comic, right? It's not like they're imitating a manga.
I do believe so.
Okay. Well, whatever. We'll find out next week, I guess. So that's what we're going to read next week. Until then, you can always find out what we're going to do the week after that or the series after that. I think we have like a month and a half leading up. that you can check out. You can find that. Just go to the website and click on future shows. The website is www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. If you want to write to us about anything we've said, or anything you want us to read, anything you disagree with, anything we got fucking wrong as hell, which please correct us. We want to hear it. You can send us an email at what's our email, David?
That would be atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
And as always, we're on the social medias. You know, we have the Facebooks and the Twitters. It's just facebook.com/APSupercast and twitter.com/APSupercast. And, you know, hop on there, send us a message, post a thing, whatever, tag us and shit. I don't care. I mean, if it's something vulgar, I'll just untag it. It's cool. Tag us on your picture of your grandma. I don't give a shit. that actually be kind of cool. And please, as always, subscribe to us on
iTunes.
All right. Cool. Well, until next week, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.